This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Creature Comforts. It's the show all about your animals and the animals around you. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. If you listen to our show, we assume that you appreciate the wildlife in your area, but how do you make your own yard an attractive location for these animals? Adam Ronke, urban wildlife specialist, and Ann Smithson from the Mississippi State University Extension Service are joining us today to help us instruct on how you can make your home comforting to the creatures around you. Join our conversation this morning. You can email animals@mpbonline.org. And if you miss Creature Comforts on Thursday, it repeats Saturday mornings at 6. So good morning, Libby. Let's start out with you. You're back in Mississippi, but we know that you were off to the Pacific Northwest for a couple of weeks for some well-deserved vacation. Any kind of final thoughts on your visit up there? And what are you seeing now that you're back home?
Yeah, I guess the fun thing was watching spring. Early spring, I think, is exciting to everybody, not just nature nerds, right? So in Oregon, we were beginning to get spring. You know, I'd started that trip with snow for the first 4 days we were there, it snowed every day, which was all right. But I was ready for spring when it came, and we started getting some spring birds there, and the leaves were budding out, and a few things. The flowers are beautiful. Oregon is almost as beautiful as Mississippi, I would say, in early spring. I can't give it the whole complete nod, but it was pretty great. So anyway, as soon as we got home, we did that overnight flight, which I don't really recommend, but it's a way to get home. So we got to our house about 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, and there were my ruby-throated hummingbirds on the red buckeye. And that's one of the wonderful things about planting native plants for your birds, in addition to just feeding them with feeders, because your yard will do the work for you when you're gone. So everybody seemed happy, and I did hang out. By the end of the day, I had the hummingbird feeders out, but they were fine with the red buckeye, I think. So if you've not seen your hummingbirds and you don't have some native plants that they're coming to in a yard for yourself, you might try hanging your feeders. This is a good time to do it. And they do need a little nourishment right now. They're migrating, and it's good once they hit Mississippi soil, I think, for them to find some food. And they'll remember that. They'll come back, which is partly why I had hummingbirds waiting for me. And now, watching the progression of our spring birds that we love to see, particularly at our house, seeing the Perula warblers, which are these gorgeous little tiny gems that go to our Spanish moss. So they were there. And then by Saturday morning, I had the prothonotaries. Paul and I both stepped out on the porch at the same time, and a little prothonotary warbler comes and gets right over our head singing. And so we thought, okay, we're really home now. And so then the last few days we've seen hooded warblers coming in. Had several of those, yellow-throated vireos and the white and red-eyed vireos, and just lots of fun things to see. So I would say this is definitely the time to start listening for birds as well as watching them. And if you've got an ear for music at all, learning the songs is sometimes easier than learning the sight visual on them. And to me, it's a lot more fun. You know, you can wake up in the morning while you're still in the bed and hear the birds singing and tell what's out in the front yard. So anyway, it's great to be back, getting ready for Nature Fest at the Natural Science Museum Saturday. That's April the 13th from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock. Lots of native animal shows, and there are tours of the labs and snakes and walks on the nature trails, and the playground's open and the food trucks will be there. So it's going to be a big day.
It's funny you said that about the birds, because I was in bed this morning waking up and I heard the bird and I thought to myself, yeah, it's that time of year where this bird is going to be outside my window chirping away.
So, okay. Was it a mockingbird?
Not sure what kind of bird it was. It was somewhat, well, I won't say annoying, but it was.
Yeah, I know.
I'm a light sleeper, so it was obviously. If someone is maybe new to trying to attract birds to the yard, especially hummingbirds, because they're such fascinating animals, remind us, if you would, of the recipe for the feeders.
Yeah. Okay. I do a cup of sugar and a quart of water. You don't have to boil the water. All the research has shown that our water is clean enough without boiling it. And so I heat the water a little bit and pour it over the sugar and then stir it up and pour it in and keep it in a quart jar in the refrigerator so there's always more. But in the fall, when I get the fall migration in, I always have more hummingbirds. So then I make it in bigger quantities, but I usually just make it by the quart. And it's not hard to do. The thing that you do need to keep very clean is the feeder, though. And my advice, because I've learned this the hard way, is a lot of the decorative feeders, ones that have a lot of little cutesies on them, those are a lot of places where funguses grow if the sugar water overflows and that kind of thing. So it's just a chance for germs. So I now kind of watch the feeders that I get. You don't have to spend a lot of money on it, but, you know, there are some very pricey ones and some not so. But I prefer one that's got a glass bottle for the drink to go in. And that way it's easier to get it clean. It'll go through the dishwasher and that kind of stuff. And just keep those little flower feeding parts where their mouths are going to go real clean. And I use an old toothbrush. I don't use soap on it. I use a really weak bleach solution and use my old toothbrush.
And obviously well rinsed after the bleach just to be on the safe side.
Yes, yeah. And if you air dry it so that all the chlorine has evaporated, then you can be sure. That way I don't worry to dry it. I sit it somewhere in the sun and let everything evaporate off of it. And then I might give it one more rinse with water and fill it up.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. As usual, Dr. Troy Major joins us from his clinic in Jackson. So good morning, Dr. Major. Today we're going to be talking about animals that people might find in their backyards and surrounding areas. Do you see a lot of people bringing in those types of creatures into the clinic?
Fortunately not. every spring we do see spring and fall, some baby squirrels people find on the ground. And sometimes little small wild bunnies. But that's about it as far as the wild. Now, if we have if a bird comes in, it's usually been injured and it has a broken wing, leg or something like that, or even concussions, because birds quite often will fly into a window. And I know Libby's talked about that a lot, about maybe putting decals on your window or aisle outside where maybe they would stay away from the windows. They seem to pick certain windows. But I'm always amazed at how the birds, and Adam may be able to tell us about this, but how amazing that the birds, even the small, tiny birds, survive these storms that we have. That's always amazed me that they're able to do that. They hunker down. Most of them are able to find a place, and they survive. Not all of them, but most of them do. But as far as other animals in the backyard, certainly raccoons are very common here. I discourage people from feeding them. However, some people are going to feed them, and you may have three to a dozen raccoons coming to eat, so they travel in kind of packs. Other than that, we don't see many things outside. You know, that's strange. Snakes are fairly common this time of year. Saw a beautiful picture of a cottonmouth moccasin looked like was very, had already eaten when it's, you know, it was quite full and great, but certainly they need to be relocated because they are poisonous, and your dogs and cats certainly can be bitten. We've seen one or two snake bites already this year from snakes that are venomous.
So if someone sees an injured animal in their yard, do you think it's worth it? I would think, A, first of all, you know, safely transporting the animal, both for the animal and the person trying to transport it to the vet, and then is there a whole lot that you can do? So is it worth it, do you think, for people to try to bring in injured animals that they find around their area?
Well, a lot of it depends on how injured they are. I know Libby can address this, but there are rehabbers, but I don't know that there's anybody right in this area right now that is rehabbing birds, and that certainly can take a lot of skill. And humane euthanasia, if the bird is beyond help, certainly is better than letting it suffer. But Libby, have you been in contact with any rehabbers lately?
You know, I haven't. I haven't had occasion to, Troy, but I was just thinking, I'll look that up. I'm glad you brought it up. It's called Animal Help Now. Do you remember that website we had talked about?
Yes.
That's got, you can put where you are, your zip code, or a local town, and it will show you who is the closest rehabber in the, and the, usually a contact information is generally a website or an email or a phone number. And it's called Animal Help Now, and it's a free app that you download. I've used
That's
it
great.
Two or three times, and it's worked.
Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, Libby Hartfield, and our guests for the day, Adam Ronke and Ann Smithson. They want to help you make your home appropriate for your creature friends. So, you know, I think a lot of people would like to see wildlife experiences from the comfort of their own home. So how can people ensure that their yards are best prepared for animal visitors? Adam, let's give you first shot at that, and then we'll hear from Ann.
Yes, thanks, guys, and I appreciate you commenting me on the phone today. I hate to not seeing everyone face-to-face. But, yeah, Libby hit on several of the kind of the fine-grained nitty-gritty, for the example of the hummingbird feeder, on what to do as far as the specifics of that particular attractant to people's backyards. But there's a lot of different things that people can do for their backyards, and it really comes back to, as I've, when I've been on before, talking about, you know, the four key things of habitat. So, you know, you're looking at food, water, shelter, and the more kind of hard to define or people to wrap their head around is space in general. So the space requirement for a critter, that basically what they need on a daily basis and on an annual basis in a given amount of space. And then depending on the critter that we're talking about, there's, you know, invertebrates and snails and things like that that could accomplish all that maybe in a 10-foot by 10-foot area under a log for its entire life cycle, whereas something like, you know, the wild turkey or white-tailed deer actually requires, you know, hundreds of acres to accomplish that. So it's really just kind of scaling down your understanding and also your expectations and what you can attract to your yard, depending on the situation and where you're located on the map, literally on the map, is step one. So it's understanding the critters that you could have in the space that you have, and then kind of going from there.
So, Ann, if you would, when we get started here, tell us a little bit about the work that you do with the Extension Service.
Yeah, so I work with Adam at the Extension Center with primarily the Urban Wildlife Project that he runs. We do a camera project observing different animals in different green spaces around the metro area. So this is in parks, golf courses, cemeteries, and then just privately owned green spaces as well, to see what kind of animals live there, and just to check on their behavior a little bit. And I also assist him with the Master Naturalist program, which I think we'll be talking a little bit more towards the end of the program, but we're actually, our class for this year is coming up, and registration is open for that now, but we'll get to that in a little bit. So
Would you say that most people would be surprised at how much urban wildlife there is in those green spaces that you were talking about?
I would say so. I think I was surprised. I don't come from I'm not a trained biologist. I don't come from a biology background, but I was surprised myself to see when I first got on board and got to look at some of the photos and validate that to see, I didn't know we had red fox in Laurel Park, or I didn't know we had, this many deer, you know, just in these places that I considered urban and may not be hospitable to white-tailed deer, but they were there and they're thriving. So it's really interesting to see that.
So, Adam, let's talk about water. So a lot of people would want to put, you know, a bird bath out, that's something that for the animals to take care of. But there's the possibility of maybe bugs or insects infesting water supply. So is there a way to sort of balance that out?
Yeah, I don't think any of us need to be worried about water right now. I think we've got plenty of it in the last 24 hours. And I think we've got more coming, unfortunately. But, so water in general, again, it's scalability. And I was joking, but it's serious in the sense that there's a lot of water on the landscape right now. And it's going to be that way for the next probably 5 to 6 days. So, it does look like it's going to turn into Mississippi summer here next week and be in the mid-80s. So as we, you know, start approaching true summer, those water resources, like we experienced last summer with the drought, water became extremely important for everything, including ourselves. You definitely can, you don't want to contribute to mosquito issues. Very similar to the hummingbird feeder, and Libby really hit on a key point of this idea that we talk about with ecological traps. You're setting up some component of a habitat to attract animals to your backyard, but if you're not able to maintain it, you could actually bring them in to some level of detriment. And the hummingbird feeder is a classic example of allowing that feeder to sit too long, particularly as it warms up. And that feed gets cloudy, that can become dangerous to the animals. And also can become a nuisance in the sense that you'll have ants and everything else all over your feeder. So she really hit on an important point there. And the same goes for bird baths or liner ponds. It can be as fancy as you want it to be. I appreciate my state salary, my job salary, but, you know, we learned to be frugal. We didn't get into wildlife biology to be rich and famous, so I actually use the bottom of plastic containers for the container pots that you can get, and I just use that, and you can paint them gold, let them dry, whatever color you want, as long as it's a safe paint product, and just fill them up with water, as long as you can keep your chocolate lab out of them from drinking, that's my issue is, just keeping that water fresh and moving. If you want to put some type of pump, or, you know, they have the drip features now, and there's some evidence to show that moving water and drip feature can pull in wildlife just from the noise of it. So, and it also keeps the water moving to reduce the mosquito larvae issue. And if you're, you know, operating a larger lined pond or one of those container garden ponds, like in a half barrel, there's pumps, and there's also, you can go with different types of fish that can help manage some of that impact too.
So are there some common ways that people are actually deterring animals from being around their homes when actually they might be wanting to do the exact opposite?
I wouldn't say necessarily deterring, but when I'm talking about with ecological traps, and I'm going to use myself as an example. I'm not going to pick anyone else. And Ando's just because I've been talking to her about it over the winter. So I'm a big fan of Turk's cap, which is a type of plant that it's really it's hard to kill. It's a red plant that the hummingbirds use, particularly in the fall. Louis, I know, is familiar with it. It really can turn into a weed, and I've had them for years in my yard. And I like them because you can literally mow them over with your mower, and they're going to come back. And even through the drought last year, they performed beautifully. I never have to water them. That's my kind of plant. Very little care needed, especially with all the traveling that myself and like Libby does for long periods of time. But I've had to actually move the plants because I had them positioned in two gardens on either side of my garage. So like what we said, you know, you could get sometimes 8-10 hummingbirds. These plants can get gigantic, like half the size of a Volkswagen after being in the ground for 10 years. So you can get a lot of birds on one plant. Well, the problem is they're right next to my garage. And if my garage is open, the garage door is open, and I have a white ceiling with the overhead lights on there, it can really become an issue of where they're zooming away from the plant, and they often would get caught up in my garage and get confused by the reflection of the light on that white ceiling. So that's a prime example at my own house, aka Bird Biologist here. And I was creating an ecological trap, because if I'm not home or I don't know that the bird is trapped in the garage and I close the door to go to work or whatnot, you know, that bird could expire by the time I get home, because they will literally beat themselves against the top of that ceiling if the light's left on. So that's a prime example where I needed to move the plants and or keep the garage door down. And I will give a little tidbit, and this is anecdotal, but you know, turning those lights off and using a smaller side door or dropping the garage door down to a very minimal level, which reduces the light reflection on that ceiling, a lot of times the birds would then let themselves out because they go towards the sunlight with that. So that's a way that you can do it without chasing them around the enclosed space and stressing them out even more. So I know a lot of people have enclosed garages, but the same thing would work for a porch. If they get confused, they just turn those lights off and they will kind of go towards the sunlight, but particularly at sunset or during the early morning.
Yeah, you know, every now and then we'll get a call from somebody that has a hummingbird in the house, and that's kind of terrifying for the poor bird. And that's generally about the only thing you can do is get it dark and attract them to a light.
Yeah, and it really works for other birds too. Another issue that I have, again, with my garage seems to be an attractant. And I know a lot of people experience this, is Carolina wrens this time of year. In fact, I took a picture that I was going to share with you guys if we were in person, but we have an old backpacking on the external frame that hangs in our garage, and it's old. It's 25-plus years old. And a Carolina wrens, in the matter of, you know, 45 minutes of walking the dog the other day, set up shop in the open pocket, side pocket of that backpack, hanging off the wall that's been there for, you know, 20 years. And, you know, I come walking in with the dog, and all of a sudden you got a little brown bird bouncing off the top of your head as you walk into the garage, and what's going on? So they can do that like in a Walmart bag. They can do it at Boots. I've had a picture sent to me of a tarp just balled up on the floor of someone's garage, and the nest was literally like 3.5 feet long in this long tube. It's incredible how fast a Carolina wren can set up shop in an open space like that. But the same thing happens. They spend all that energy creating that nest. And in some cases, if they're able to go far enough and actually deposit eggs, now you kind of set them up for failure with that. Now, all that to say, if that does happen, it's not necessarily the end of the world. The Carolina wrens are doing just fine. But it's just an example of people trying to provide habitat in their backyard, and in some cases can actually lead them to a negative outcome, unbeknownst to themselves and also the animals.
You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Major has remained on the line. If you have a pet question, he can help you out with that. Email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. Kevin Farrell here on Creature Comforts with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. We have two guests for the hour, visiting with Adam Ronke and Ann Smithson. If you missed any of today's show, you can always subscribe to the podcast by using any podcasting app, or you can download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone, and you can listen to all the MPB Think Radio programs, the local ones, on your schedule. If you want to join our conversation this morning, you can email animals@mpbonline.org. We do have a caller to get to, so we will say good morning to Marion, who's called in from Clinton. Good morning. You're on the air with us, so go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much. I have a relative who has a very small front porch. She has several birds who every year build a nest kind of towards the roof line, have babies, and they cover her front porch with their droppings, or at least there are some droppings. She thinks the solution is to remove the eggs and to make the mamas sad so that they will leave. And I don't think that that is a viable solution. I think it's a terrible solution. And I'm trying to think of what type of advice I can give her so that, you know, quite frankly, she won't remove the eggs.
Okay, yes, we don't want her to remove the eggs. Has the nest already started this year?
Yes, yes. And that's her plan, is to, you know, she'd have to get up on a ladder, but she's assuming that there are going to be eggs and she wants to remove them.
At this point, when she's already got the nest there, my encouragement would be to put something protective down, whether it's a little tarp or something. And I'm looking at Anne to see if she's got a better idea. She and Adam may come up with another one. But I just put something down to protect the area that's going to get soiled, because it's not going to be long. You know, it's just, what, she's got 2 or 3 weeks probably. If you can protect that. But to get ready for in the future, I would say she can think about, we've done this, is to build the birds a little shelf to nest on for the next year. And we've got our Phoebes back on the nest that we built for them. We built 3 different places, and they kind of rotate between them, and they're building a nest there now. But put them somewhere where you wouldn't mind having them, that is also protected. Kind of look at the situation that's going on where the nest is that you don't want to have there. There's a reason why the bird picked that exact spot, probably. Unless it's a Carolina wren who will build anywhere. Yeah, then you can put a shoe out. But if you build another similar type situation in an area that you're okay with, then there's a good chance they'll go there. And you can kind of fill up that ledge, do something with the ledge the next year when you've provided an alternate place that's okay with you. Does that make sense?
It does. So maybe she would do this close to her front porch, but not where it overhangs on her front porch.
Yeah.
So that if the same birds come back, they'll gravitate to this new shelf, especially if she blocks the other place.
Yes, yes. If she makes it attractive enough. But if they're, you know, they like that protected overhang of the porch. Right. So you're going to need to have some kind of a protected overhang for the new one. And if you can make it oriented in the same, in the same way, if it's on the west side of the house facing, you know, depending on however they like that, I would say try to duplicate it as much as possible.
Yeah, I will build something for her. I appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Good luck, and let us know what happens. And I don't know, real quick, Anne, you or Adam have a better solution or an additional solution?
I'll let Adam chime in. He's the bird expert between the two of us. So if he has anything.
No, Libby, you hit it right on the head. I was going to offer if you wanted to send us some photos, you can send it to either to the show or to my email address. It's just my name, Adam. Adam.Ronke, Ronke, at msstate, .edu. And we can figure out what species of bird that it is. It could be Phoebe, like Libby just mentioned. It could also be a barn swallow, which I'm thinking it possibly is, which would be different things that we could try to do for that. But Libby hit it right on the head of providing an alternate location. And then you talked about blocking. We use a fancy word because we're from the university called exclusion, but we would recommend in that scenario to keep them off the porch of putting a very fine netting up underneath to keep them from reestablishing underneath there, and try to find an alternate location because, like Libby said, they like that spot for a reason and they're going to get to it whichever way they can. So we would just need some more pictures of the nest, and we can kind of give you more specifics on how to make that as successful as possible.
All right, Marion, thanks for your call. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We are talking about urban wildlife this morning. Also, Dr. Major remaining on the line for pet questions, or if you have just kind of a general wildlife question that you want us to talk about, go ahead and give us a call. Like I said, some open phone lines. So, Anne, I think earlier you had mentioned about the wildlife cameras that are set up around Jackson. Remind us again of some of the types of animals you're seeing on those cameras.
Yeah, so the two species that we see the most are going to be the eastern gray squirrel and the white-tailed deer. Those are across the board in all parts of the metro area. Those are the two animals that we're seeing the most. And I think you can ask anyone, you know, what wildlife have you seen, and they'll probably say squirrels and deer, right? We've seen foxes, both red and gray. We've seen other species of squirrels. So we've seen some fox squirrels, and actually we've seen some southern flying squirrels over in Pearl and then also up in Madison. What else have we seen? We've seen some nutria. We actually saw some otters also up in Madison, which is very exciting. We've only seen them once, though, so I'm hoping that we'll get to see them again sometime soon. But we've seen a really good variety of different animals, lots of different domestic animals, to domestic dogs, domestic cats, both kept, and then also some feral animals. So just a few different species across the board.
An otter, where did you see that? That sounds really interesting.
We saw that up in Madison in Liberty Park. So if you are going down Madison Avenue, it is right next to the baseball fields over there, I think. So there's a nice little river waterway there, and we get a lot of activity through the corridor where we have our camera. I won't disclose exactly where it is, so no one goes and tries to see for themselves. But we've seen some really cool animals there just moving along. We've seen, that's exactly where we saw the flying squirrel as well. So that's one of our hot spots, I guess we like to say. So,
Adam, from what you've observed on some of these wildlife cameras and things, does wildlife tend to change their behavior drastically in the urban setting as opposed to other areas?
That really can depend. So we have the cameras all the way from downtown Jackson, so literally Smith Park, all the way out to almost Canton, and then from just outside of Clinton all the way over to Brandon, and we're adding more cameras in that direction. So the behavior can change depending on the landscape, even at the very localized level. For example, one of the fun photos that we have on our website, the people can just Google the Jackson Urban Wildlife Project, and our story map website will show up. And this is the infamous photo of the gray squirrel jumping through Smith Park with a full slice of pizza in its mouth. So there's a behavior change for you. Some of these species, hence the category that we put them in, urban adapters. They can adapt not only their behavior, but also their foraging behavior. And, you know, literally that slice of pizza was the size of the squirrel itself. I don't know how it carried that thing off, but let alone jump over an area.
Box, you know, yeah.
It was airborne with the pizza in its mouth.
And so, it had another squirrel hot on its tail, too. So it obviously was in competition.
So it's just replacing some of those natural calories with things that they find. But we see that with a lot of animals. Some of the largest raccoons I've ever seen live just off of North Park Mall property, where we have some other cameras, doing very well, eating out of Tico Steakhouse dumpsters and things like that. They're very adaptable, not only in their activity patterns, but also in their food consumption. To the point where, you know, some of these critters are getting a little thick in the waist because of the different food that they're consuming.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Looks like we've got a caller on the line. This, I think, might be a follow-up to our previous call. So let's say good morning to Wayne, who calls in from Taylor. Good morning, Wayne. You're on the air, so go ahead.
Good morning. I'm a house painter, and several times I've painted the porch ceilings on houses blue, and it's pretty well eliminated barn swallows, street sparrows, and red wasp nests.
Great. I have heard that. And I think, Libby, you've talked about that in the past, have you not? Isn't your porch blue, I believe?
Yes. Yeah, we do the blue ceiling, yes. And it seems to work for us. I haven't done any scientific study. I don't have another porch that's not blue to test it with. But every now and then we will get a wasp nest, but generally it's on the base. There are three ceiling fans along that porch, and usually the wasp nest will be in association with something of the ceiling fan that is, I think they're black and tan. So I like the blue ceiling, and I kind of feel like it works at least to some degree.
All right, Wayne, thanks for your call. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're going to continue talking throughout this hour with our guests, Adam Ronke and Ann Smithson. Also, Dr. Major still on the line, ready for any pet questions that you might have. To join our conversation, email animals@mpbonline.org. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major and Libby Hartfield, our guests today, Adam Ronke and Ann Smithson. Still time to join the conversation. You can email animals@mpbonline.org. We do have a caller on the line, so off to Ocean Springs we go this time. Marcy has called in today. Good morning, Marcy. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. I, for a long time, have wanted to know how I can get involved locally. I have seen red foxes, otters, bunnies, turtles. You know, I just see animals, and I want to know, how can I help?
You need to go to the Master Naturalist class. Yes. Did Adam tell you to call? No. Yeah. Yeah, you really need to get trained to do some of this. They're looking for volunteers to help with this urban wildlife investigation that they're doing. Ann can talk about that.
Sure.
Right now.
Yeah. So if you're down in Ocean Springs, there's actually a Coastal Master Naturalist chapter, and that's run by Eric Sparks. I believe, Adam can correct me if I'm wrong, they do those courses in the fall. Our chapter, the Central chapter, ours is coming up here in the summer. But once you're trained, we train Master Naturalists to then help us with the Urban Wildlife Camera Project. And part of that, some of our volunteers actually go out into the field and help us set our cameras, but we also have volunteers who, from the comfort of their homes or wherever they have their computer or their tablet, help us tag the imagery that we collect on our cameras. So if you're interested in getting involved with that, you can reach out to me or Adam. My email is just Ann.Smithson, so Ann.Smithson. @msstate.edu, and you can reach out to me and we can talk more about getting trained up for the program. But I'm happy to hear that you're so interested in that. We really love the project, and we're, you know, hoping to bring in more volunteers to help us with it. So they've really been the driving force of getting our project done. So we really appreciate all the help we can get.
Awesome. Okay, I will email you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Marcy. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. So, Adam, now that we brought up the Master Naturalist class, if you could tell us a little bit more about what people who are participating in that, what are some of the activities and things that go on?
Yeah, I'll hit on a couple things, and I'll turn some of it over to Ann, since we're doing it a little different this year by request from folks over the last couple of years. But you have one of our very first Master Naturalists, which I still think she should have taught the course instead of taking it. But when Libby decided to retire, I think it was 3 days after she retired, she took one of our first courses with the university. And the museum has been a partner since day one with our course. But if people are familiar with the Extension Service, a lot of people are familiar with our Master Gardener program, mm-hmm. Which is based on the same format. It's basically a crunch course of in the case of Master Gardener, it's for gardening, but for us, it's Mississippi wildlife and outdoors, basically. So it's essentially what Livy and I went through in our undergrad program as biologists. And so instead of 4 years, we cram it into 8 weeks, which is a lot to do. But it's a very basic introduction. Fun and basic introduction to all things Mississippi wildlife and outdoors. So we do that through, we have, Ann, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we're in the ballpark of 12, 13 co-instructors, all
mm-hmm,
active.
About that.
Active biologists that work with us as co-instructors and highlight their specialty, ranging from Libby always messed this up. I guess it would be your worst half. Paul helped us with the Mississippi River ecology aspect. We've covered the Pearl River. We do a section now on urban wildlife in Jackson. We cover fisheries, ornithology, entomology, soils, plants. We give it, again, a very basic introduction with that, and then we always have a very, very much hands-on experience that I think Libby can attest to with that. We have a lot of success with this program. We're entering our, I think, our 10th or 11th offering now here in Jackson area, but I'll let Ann highlight this year that's going to be a little different, and we're trying to do this to accommodate more people that work full-time.
Yeah, so like Adam said, one of the, and I don't want to call them complaints, but the laments, I guess, for people who are interested in taking the course, in the past we've done it all in person, and so if it's an 8-week course, that's 8 days you have to take off from work to come into the course. So actually this year we're offering it as a hybrid course, so it'll run from May 17th to July 12th. But instead of 8 in-person days, we'll actually only be meeting in person 4 times, and that will all be on Fridays. So hopefully that will lessen a little bit of the burden on that. But the it'll be a hybrid course. And so in addition to the in-person meetings, which are basically field days, going out into the field and using stuff that we learn from the online modules, we will release content from the same experts that help us with our activities through an online learning course that will be released asynchronously, meaning that people who are in the course can kind of complete the content at their own time and just have to have, you know, reviewed it and be prepared for when we actually meet in person. So it's a more flexible time commitment while still giving those hands-on activities that I think a lot of our Master Naturalists say are the highlights of the course. And if you're interested in learning more and want to learn more about the cost, which days we'll be meeting in person, the website, you can either Google MS Master Naturalists, and it should be the first result, or you can go to masternaturalist.extension.msstate.edu. And at that toolbar at the top, if you just look at courses, if you click on that, it should have the link to our central Mississippi Master Naturalist course for summer 2024.
And we are talking about the central chapter, but we do have listeners across the state. And as you mentioned, there are other, so if someone lives outside the central Mississippi area, they could still find out about something in their area.
Yes. Yeah, so currently we only have 2 chapters. So there's the central course, which is kind of Hines, Warren, Madison, and Rankin County. And then we have the coastal chapter, which is down on the coast. We've had people ask about if we would expand, you know, to Starkville, to main campus, or up into North Mississippi. We would love to do that, but right as it stands now, it's only the 2 chapters currently. But we hope with the central having a little bit more flexibility, people who might not have had the ability to come for those 8 in-person meetings, this would lessen that burden a little bit.
So Adam, got about 30 seconds left. We mentioned the wildlife cameras. Is there a way that maybe go online somewhere where the public can see what the cameras are catching?
Yes. Yeah. If you just go to Jackson, Mississippi Urban Wildlife Project, Google that, our story map will pop up, which is an interactive website that Ann's been instrumental on building. So you can interact with the website and the map of the actual sites where our cameras are. We show you highlight photos and some of the cool stories related to that. And she's actually building that out more, where we'll have cultural information and history on the parks and how they got established. And a lot more cool info coming in the next couple months.
All right, that's going to wrap us up for today. Creature Comforts is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio. To hear today's show or previous show, you can search for Creature Comforts on your favorite podcasting app or download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone. Our show is produced and engineered by Abram Nanny, and our call screener was Charles Arnold. So for Dr. Troy Major, Libby Hartfield, and our guests, Adam Ronke and Ann Smithson, I'm Kevin Farrell. Stay tuned up next at 10. It's AutoCorrect with Coach Charlie Melton. We'll be back here next Thursday at 9 for another Creature Comforts. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.